and I'll let you know when you're at 30 minutes.
Okay, great. Gilad, thanks for coming on Channel 9 again.
Always a pleasure.
Cool. And I think this time, really what I want to do is talk about what you've been working on for several years, Newspeak, mm-hmm. sort of get a sense of, you know, what problems are you trying to solve? Why are you creating this? What does it do? What does it enable?
Okay, so I guess I've been thinking specifically about these ideas for a lot longer than I actually worked on them. But it's April, so it's 5 years. Gmail was released April Fool's Day 2004. And I started using it very shortly thereafter. And I was initially very enthusiastic until I actually used it for half an hour. And then I realized, no, this isn't what I want at all. Because what I wanted was something that combined the best of the web world and the traditional client world. I wanted something that was rich and pleasant to interact with, but had this advantage of always being up to date and you know, connecting to the network and things like that. And being a language person, you know, whatever the problem is, the answer has got to be a language, right? Mm-hmm. There is no other way of solving problems. If you have to drill a hole, you need a language. That's the way I am, right? So I basically wanted to make it easy to build such apps.
Okay.
And Newspeak isn't there yet, but the goal was this notion of objects as software services, which I've talked about elsewhere. There's a talk on Google, whatever it is, video.
Okay.
And where basically the idea was that you would program as you normally program. You don't worry about where the objects are and where stuff is. You program an application, it can run locally. If it explicitly needs to get some resource out there, it can talk to that asynchronously. But a lot of the stuff simply can be synchronized from just as you synchronize a calendar. Your objects get synchronized.
Interesting.
And objects come with program, right? Objects are behavior and state, and all of that gets synchronized, so you never run an old version of your program. You don't. Your deployment strategy is essentially a service rather than an artifact. So you can run offline, disconnected, say, a word processor when you land in Inner Mongolia and you need to write a report or do a presentation and you can't rely on the fact that it'll be out there on the net or something. But at the same time, when you do have a connection, it synchronizes back. It's backed up on a server. It's available for other people to see, to collaborate, all the advantages of that kind of web ecology. And the idea was to make it really easy by being able to synchronize the objects that you usually program with. And there are a bunch of language features that help with that, making metaprogramming very easy, reflectivity, making sure that all access to objects is via virtual method calls. So there's always this indirection where you can, you know, adapt things or update them, that all your code is representation independent in a sense. It doesn't care where the actual fields are or things like that. So those are features that found their way into Newspeak. This whole synchronization story will, you know, it's a very blue sky vision and it'll take a while to materialize.
Absolutely.
So right now, Newspeak it doesn't do those particular things, but it still turned out to be a very pleasant language to work with because I think we did some cool stuff. And
interesting.
If you ask me nicely, I'll tell you about it.
Tell me about what are some of these cool stuff. I mean, the notion of object as service, I must say, is incredibly interesting. But one question I would ask in that sort of blue sky vision is, How does dependency play a role here? So the ideal composable system is you can remove something, doesn't break the system. You can put it back in, adds new functionality.
Right. So this was another of the motivations. My 10 years in the Java world, the trauma that left me with was the trauma that you share at Microsoft is, right, you can never take stuff out. Once you have a user community of any size, your mistakes live forever. You can never find a better way of doing something. You just can't get rid of the old stuff. And so you have this curse of compatibility where things can only bloat. They can grow. You can add stuff, but you cannot take things out. And I realized that in this ideal vision of we already are in a networked world. And so if you really backed up your data and your programs on this shared service, you can modify it. You can find it. The big problem we had with Java is, you know, there's this obscure feature. The spec even didn't say it did that, but there was a bug once that supported it, and now people are relying on it, and we don't know who they are. And We don't even know how to contact them, except, you know, just broadcast to the world that this won't work. We don't know how serious it is, what timeline, how to coordinate with them. You can find them. If it's on a service, you can essentially, as if the world is your ID, you can find out everyone who's calling this method. And if it's deprecated, here's the new method. All the calls should be changed, and, you know, there's usually some refactoring you can do. And here's a script that'll do it. And all the code in the world can be brought up. Okay, so this is, there are people who think that I'm loony, right? But but this is the vision, the idea that you can take things out. That's actually why it's called Newspeak, because the language in George Orwell's novel, which bugs certain people, had this notion that they would keep shrinking the language.
Interesting.
Instead of talking about how you grow it, I'm interested in how you can. You can ever actually get to the point where you can shrink your software. And the same would be true of applications here, because you could always, or your objects are data living with methods and behavior. If you keep them together and you have them on the service, you can update. You don't have to have 20 old file formats you're supporting, right? You can change the data when you change the program. It evolves in tandem.
Interesting.
You don't worry about dusty decks out there that you have to be compatible with.
Interesting. Now, what about the notion of security, right?
Okay, so security is a big thing for network programming, and I'm not a fan of the current schemes that are used. The scheme that's used in Java, well, the thing is it usually isn't used. Mm. At least part of it isn't used. The whole Java security framework in practice is reused very rarely because it's very expensive to use, and once people have to pay for performance beyond a certain point, they tend to throw security out the window. Mm. And which gives you no security at all. The other part of it that is used is verification of the bytecodes, which is a huge problem, and that's a whole other discussion, which we may or may not get to, and we've mentioned before.
Okay.
So there's a whole other approach, capability-based security. That, again, the notion of capabilities comes from the good old days of the 60s and 70s when a lot of the core research was done that is the foundation of everything we do today. Mm. And the idea there is, not to try and check whether you're allowed to do X and Y and keep tracing and going up stacks to see who called whom and what, but to say, well, if there's something you shouldn't be allowed to do, the only way you can do it is if we give you a capability, something that can do that. Capability in general could be a crypto key, or it can be an object that, you know, has a method that knows how to do it and is the only one that actually has access to the real data or whatever it is you have to modify. And if you don't have that capability, we don't have to check anything. If we didn't hand you that thing, you don't have it. So this is an approach that makes a lot more sense to me and is a much more natural fit with object orientation. And this is not to say that we have secure APIs or there's a huge amount of effort to do that sort of thing, to actually audit and software. But the base, if you don't put security from the ground up, if the basic architecture doesn't support you, then no amount of work later is gonna dig you out of that hole. And so the basic framework of the language supports that very, very naturally. There are two key ideas in Newspeak. One is that everything's late-bound. All names are late-bound, without exception. Classes, methods, fields, all of it are essentially treated the same. Hmm. Essentially, you can consider it that every name is a virtual method call. Hey, the syntax makes that easy. It's not painful to deal with, but the basic behavior is that everything's a virtual method call. The other thing is there's no global scope at all. There is no global namespace. And what that means is the top-level classes, they're essentially module definitions. There is no scope for them to see around them, right? They are the top. So at the top level, they are completely independent units. And when you instantiate them, the objects you instantiate, they are actual modules. They're inherently sandboxed. Mm. Because the only thing they can get at is stuff that slots of their own that were defined by the class, or things that were passed in when you instantiated the object to the factory method that makes them. That's the only connection to the outside world. So the arguments to the, if you will, constructor are your capabilities. So to make this a little more concrete, suppose you don't want someone to write to the file system. You don't pass them anything that knows how to write files or create files, and you don't have to check if they're going. So if you want to run something in a sandbox that doesn't do that, you basically, they're inherently dependent on what you gave them. Those capabilities define a sandbox.
Interesting. So you built in isolation at the object level, or the class level.
Yeah.
How do these classes communicate? I mean, is it just message? I mean, if I want to instantiate a class that is able to communicate with another class, I just do that in the constructor?
So I don't want to use the phrase constructor too much because we don't really have constructors.
We have our instances, factory methods. Okay.
So maybe we will use a whiteboard.
Excellent.
If we have something to write.
We do have something to write on.
Here they are. There we go. Okay, so I'm gonna write this in sort of pseudo mainstream syntax.
Excellent.
Which I'll make up as I go along because I don't assume most of your viewers are familiar with the Smalltalk-y kind of syntax we actually
use. There may be some out there, but that's fine.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
So let's say we have a class. And imagine that you had a method header here. You'd have to say, so you define class C, and then you wrote a method signature.
Okay.
Like, foo of, some type. Well, it's an untyped language. It's a dynamic type language. So we'll skip the types, but we'll say, some argument. Maybe I'll make this more concrete and real as we go along, right?
Okay.
And then you'd have a class, and maybe you'd say extends, or what is it you guys say?
You don't say extends.
Yes, you have to innovate.
Do the colon. There you go.
One colon, two colon?
One colon.
One colon, right. So here you say whatever, some super class. And there's an issue with that, but we'll get to that. Or not. Right? And then you have this. So what this would mean is, this is a definition of a class. Ideally, it's actually an expression. It is a real value. It evaluates to a class object.
Mm.
And because I wrote this, that class object has a method called foo.
Yes.
And you can pass it some parameters. Those are your capabilities. Then there is, let's say, something like, I don't know if you guys have instance initializers like in Java, but at least that's something that a lot of people may have heard of.
Okay.
There's some section here which is the initialization section. This is where the fields are defined, F1, F2, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here you would say p dot, what's the name of a major collection class in .NET? Because your APIs are similar yet slightly different. Let's say list. There must be something called list, right? Okay? And I'll put a semicolon.
Yeah,
so I'm making this all right.
Great.
What you've done here, imagine that p is some object representing your sandbox, your surrounding platform.
Okay.
You've passed it in here when it gets created.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about how that happens, because that's the thing that confuses people. Like, where do I start, right? But we'll get to that. Now, the code in this initializer is initializing the fields of this object based, and it can access this parameter. But this parameter isn't in scope later on here in the methods of the class, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's this initializer gets executed when you create an object, right? When you, essentially, the magic of the language ensures that the result of this thing, the class C, has a method foo that I can call, and when I call it, I will create a new instance of C, and when that instance is created, I'll run this code.
Interesting.
And that will extract things from the sandbox. So if I'm allowed to get it lists, then I'll send it something that has, again, a method list, which will return me a class object representing the list class. So now I've got my imports here. There's no uses, no imports. This is completely parametric. But all my external dependencies are listed up here explicitly. I'm just using the regular field initialization, as it were, to extract them and put them in fields which are available to the rest of the code. And the rest of the code only sees these guys. So I know that my dependencies had to be extracted here.
Interesting.
Right? So that's how we do essentially imports, but the difference, unlike imports, right? Imports or uses or whatever, the problem is you name something specific that you're dependent on.
Mm-hmm.
The analogy I always use is, you have your laptop. That's a piece of hardware. That's a module you can pick up and take. Imagine if it specified that it always had to be, there's a plug for the power cable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an import is saying we take that power cable and we follow it and dig up through the ground and eventually you end up in the power station and we drag all of that with us because we've already specified what we're tied to.
Uh-huh.
We haven't decoupled ourselves. We simply made the coupling explicit. We said, there's a point where the power comes in. But we didn't say that it can be connected to any power supplier. We said, we're connected to, PG&E or whoever you have up here in Washington State.
Sure.
Right? And you take their power station wherever you go. That isn't real modularity like a piece of hardware. These things are parametric. They depend on those parameters, and it's explicit, and that fits perfectly with the security story.
Mm-hmm.
So take an example, you don't want someone to use reflection.
Okay.
Right? So again, you pass them some environment. It's there's a standard. We call it the platform object.
Mm-hmm.
And it should, you know, depending on the context, you trust them to do X or Y. And maybe you pass them a platform object that doesn't let you do reflection. It has no reflection classes in it. There's no way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing, this is how we also do foreign function calls. A lot of, like, say in the Java platform, all these managed platforms, you know, if you go to C code, well, the C code can trash everything you're doing, right?
Yes.
Now, because we don't have a language construct for a native call or a foreign call,
mm-hmm.
we do this with objects. We have alien objects that know how to communicate, right? They're wrappers that do know how to get out and talk to something else.
Okay.
But if you don't have one of those guys, there isn't a construct you can write that'll do a C call for you, right? You cannot make foreign calls. I can write a module and know that there is no way for it to call out.
Okay.
And it's all an artifact of that same capability-based approach that just falls out.
Interesting. So, I mean, the immediate thing that comes to mind is, you know, using Newspeak, now going to the real language,
mm-hmm.
you know, what would that look like on, say, you know, Windows, where you want to actually call into Win32 so you can do useful things on the
yeah.
host operating system?
Yeah, we do that. We do that all the time, in
yeah.
fact. Basically, the VM has essentially primitive support, a mechanism for doing C calls.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
Now, the question is, how is this surfaced to the language? And rather than surfacing it through a language construct,
mm-hmm.
essentially, right now we're in an intermediate state because we're hosted on Squeak Smalltalk, which is as insecure a system as you could ever imagine, right? It's designed for openness and play and whatever, and hopeless to try to secure it directly. But in principle, the way we want to surface it is through what we call a VM mirror. The virtual machine should have whatever primitives that are basic to the system are operations on the virtual machine. Virtual machine, again, is an object you're talking to and sending requests to by calling methods on it.
Okay.
And so the VM mirror object is the object that actually has the real capability to call C. And when you code an alien, it needs that capability.
Okay.
And so, again, if you pass someone the VM mirror, well, that could be system libraries that you've written that you want to be able to do these things, and you generally wouldn't pass it to Joe User.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's how that approach covers essentially everything in terms of restricting access to things. How do you, in practice, where do you start is kind of what's kind of... Because, okay, so this can't see anything.
Yeah.
You can call it, but how did I call it? I mean, where did I write the code that calls it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in most environments, there's always this is a tooling issue. You know, if you write a make file, right, it's relying on a namespace that's induced by the operating system, by the directory it's in, essentially, right? You're naming whatever files you happen to have, right? That is sort of a global namespace, but it only refers to whatever you actually have in hand. That's how you connect the pieces of software you have.
Okay.
Right? So there are several ways to accomplish this. Our idea is to have an application. The IDE is an application that would provide you a namespace. Say you'd have an interactively or however an operation. Say, you know, fetch me this file, compile it, and when you compile it, well, now you can reflect on it and see that it's a class and what its name is, and then you can basically slam that in a field. And create a namespace for me that I can interact in, where a place where I can actually type code where those names will be bound.
Okay.
And then I can bring in the pieces of my application and glue them together by calling these factory methods, passing the different pieces as arguments, and setting them up.
Hmm.
And in the end, I create an object that represents my application. And I can then serialize that object, just as you just do plain object serialization. That's essentially our binary format.
Hmm.
You serialize that object, it has all the pieces of code it needs. Because classes don't have any state, there are no static variables or anything, then it doesn't drag in kind of unforeseen things when you serialize that way.
Okay.
And that is basically something that you can, you know, take and go to another Newspeak runtime. And what that runtime would do would be to suck in, deserialize the object.
Hmm.
And there needs to be a convention of, you know, basically the object has a main method, just like a C program has a main function, right, an entry point.
Sure.
It's a convention that you know. That that serialized object is essentially like your A dot out or something.
Hmm.
And, of course, there should be convenient ways to package this into an executable and various bells and whistles. And we, you know, some of that isn't, we know how to do that. We did that when at Cadence, but it still required more knowledge than I'd expect the average developer to have, and we're trying to bring it to a point where it's a push-button sort of thing.
Excellent. So, now, I mean, you said, so there's no concept of static,
mm-hmm.
And so what I'm wondering, and no shared state.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things alone are really interesting, particularly the shared state problem.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to, I mean, one of the big problems today, mm-hmm. That everybody's thinking about, is concurrency,
mm-hmm.
right? And parallelism. And those two aren't the same
yeah.
things, but they're related.
Yeah.
And let's say you have a 1,000-core machine.
Mm-hmm.
Shared state becomes a problem
mm-hmm.
in a, you know, 1,000 times what it is today.
Yeah.
Can we talk about, like, where does Newspeak fit into this notion of distribution and coordination and concurrency?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm hedging my bets here, right? But basically, because there's no static state, it really, the state you share is when you actually choose to, if you want to share state with different modules, you plug them, you wire them together and pass the parameters around, right?
Mm.
But you can program functionally, you speak, right? Obviously, we have closures and all that stuff. And the interesting thing about the language is that there's only one real construct that makes it an imperative language at all. Because the way things work, everywhere you access any value, it's a method call.
Mm.
Right? So where do you actually expose that there's modifiable fields? It's essentially, the syntax is different, but it's here, right? These guys.
Okay.
And the real syntax actually, there are slots you initialize pretty much like this with an equal sign.
Mm-hmm.
And there are slots that we have this different syntax where you initialize, you know, p dot, I don't know, whatever, name it map. Right? So this is a little strange to do because this would be a modifiable slot.
Okay.
And this would be an immutable slot.
Ah.
Okay, now an immutable slot, what does that mean? We just generate a getter method for it,
okay.
but no setter method.
All right.
Which means that no code can change it, except for this initial, the point where you actually initialized it. After
mm-hmm.
that, there's no way to change it. There just isn't a mechanism to change it.
A capability, as you were saying.
In a way, yeah, because there's no assignment statement or anything.
Hmm.
You're calling a method, and the only method we've given you is one that can read it, but not a method that can change it.
Okay.
So you're almost to a functional language now. If you take out that one construct, you're almost functional. The only thing that isn't purely functional is that the order of these things, right, they're initially nil or something, you might see that, and one of the things that's on my list is to introduce some sort of Lettrek-like thing that'll that will avoid dependency on order, so that you will completely be able to write pure applicative code if you want to. Now, that doesn't tell me, you know, that puts me in the same position as the functional guys, right? That doesn't mean that they've solved the problem, but they certainly that is certainly one approach to doing it, and the fact that I do not depend on anything global is a big help here.
Absolutely. So I mean, let's talk. You know, brass tacks. I mean,
I'm way out of
camera.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we got it pretty far back.
He's covering it. Yeah.
So I mean, what do you want people to use this for initially? Right. I mean, I'd love to have some Niners download Newspeak and play with it, and give you feedback,
mm-hmm.
and we'll present them with a way of doing that, but.
Yeah.
Let's get down to the brass tacks. What do you want out of this? What do you think developers are going to get?
At this stage, you know, we're still early, so I hesitate to foist it on the unsuspecting, right? But it's an early adopter thing, right? If
uh-huh.
you want to be exposed to something different and you basically play, right? There are lots of people who love to play with different programming languages. It's actually robust enough because we're running on Squeak, which is actually a platform that's been around a long time. You know, it's reliable. At Cadence, we built applications that we actually handed over to customers as early adopters to play with.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a real issue with making software that works, but packaging it in the standard way still requires a bit more understanding than I'd like, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a push-button way to turn it into an executable yet.
Uh-huh.
So that's actually my main hesitation, because on Windows in particular, if you've seen the demos and stuff, well, we use the native Windows libraries. It runs on both XP and Vista and on Windows 7.
Excellent.
It's basically the GUI. We have libraries that do essentially platform-independent GUI, but they bind to native stuff, so it really runs on Win32, basically GUI primitives. It would have been a lot easier to do it just on WPF,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, nobody, I mean, Cadence was an XP shop too. I mean, nobody was willing to live only with those APIs.
Okay.
So in any case, you get real windows that interact, and you can call any C function you want, right? It's fairly easy and fairly efficient to call C from this, unlike say Squeak itself, because that's one of the things we had to change.
Okay.
But if you really wanted to do sort of basically an interactive like client application, that's what's really fun to do, and what I think it's most suitable at this point. Then you still have this deployment issue.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deploy? And that's been a curse on Smalltalk for a long time because it's very hard traditionally to separate out applications from the development environment.
Interesting.
Now, because we can actually serialize modules, and because our modules, they're stateless, they're not tied to anything, unlike in Smalltalk or anything that had static state that would... Mm-hmm. Now you can actually produce a standalone serialized object, but we actually still don't have a convenient way for you to package it in an executable, right? Essentially, you'd have to still have the IDE image to read that thing back in and so forth. So there's a bunch of mechanics that aren't quite there yet. Hopefully, in the next few months, we're now an open source project and we're moving along.
Cool.
So at this stage, I'd say that people should play with it and you know, get a different perspective on things. But it's probably not quite where it's, you know, I expect the unsuspecting user.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a small talker or something, then definitely, if you've been willing to deploy that, you can certainly use Newspeak. But it'll be easier. In terms of, you know, modularity and the potential for security, but it's still everything's evolving. APIs are evolving. It's a very young system, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and it needs adopters to play around with it.
Absolutely.
And help you guys out.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit, like fast forward a little bit to the future. When you do have it to the extent that you really have sort of realized your idea of objects as services.
Mm-hmm.
What is the composition? What does the architecture look like? Am I writing as a developer? I have sort of I got to have some sort of storage system that holds my database or my objects in the sky and then running on the client, so then I synchronize that way, right?
Well, the whole point is that the language will do that for you.
Okay. Oh, right? Implicitly.
So, right. So the point is you would identify your slots as either transient or not.
Okay.
And how that mechanism works, there's at least two schemes and things that we've experimented with, so it's still premature. But the whole idea is that you don't have to worry about that. You just identify which are the which objects should be persistent, because a lot of them are just transient data that's being computed. You don't want to store everything.
Sure.
But sort of your business objects, the things that matter that should stay persistent, you basically will map the slots that hold those, and then by essentially like garbage collection, by reachability, that subset of the heap that you need that they're connected to gets synchronized. And then there's a whole issue of how in practice, what's the model here, where does this service live?
Exactly.
Right? And that's why it's blue sky. There's a lot to figure out, right? A large company... Mm-hmm. Like Google or Microsoft would be the ideal host for this, because, you know, they have the clout and the reliability and the server farms and all that to say, here, we're offering you an opportunity to use it, sort of an app store with backup built in.
Sure.
Right? That's sort of my dream, because there's a small problem of convincing people to actually go with it. But but that's the idea, that you would develop software. You know, nowadays, you know, people are very keen on posting their apps on, say, the App Store with the iPhone, but everybody's trying to do something similar. And you do this, the ecology for desktops and PCs would be similar. You'd put it on the App Store, there'd be a way for people, then they'd synchronize and get that app. And from then on, they'd always get the updates transparently.
Amazing.
Right? Yeah, and their data would be backed up. So presumably that's maybe how they'd pay for this, because they already pay for storage and backup. That's one of the few things you can still charge people for in the software world. So it's moving from a world where you sell apps as artifacts to a world where you subscribe to them as a service.
Yes.
That's kind of the out there vision.
Well, I mean, the thing I think is brilliant about this, actually. I mean, the notion of software as a service has been around for a while, and Microsoft and other companies are actually starting to realize it. But the notion of, you know, down at the object level, as a service.
That's why it's
just
objects
awesome.
And software services. That's why I'm...
It's a great idea. Yeah. I mean, I could just imagine these server farms, object server farms, and they just communicate. And what I would recommend you do is spin up an instance of Windows Azure. Look, here's a good use for you. And I'm not marketing to you.
Yeah.
You could actually create a little server farm on Windows Azure that would host your objects in the sky, your synchronizable objects, and play around. And you get the hosting for free, the scanning for free. You'll have to figure out the abstraction layer.
That's true. So when we get to the point where all this thing actually, that synchronization story works, definitely the various major players who are providing these cloud services, and especially if they let me, it really depends what kind of software you can host on them, because they're sort of not. I'm not actually up on the details of who lets you. I think on Windows you can pretty much host anything that'll run on Windows on these things on Azure. So, because it may be that the server is customized. It's not just your vanilla Apache framework that people are providing. But that is definitely the scheme would be to presumably get. To try this idea out with a suitable set of early adopters, right? A bunch of nuts who are willing to go with me.
Yeah, there's plenty of them around.
Yeah, there's plenty of them around. And so that's a bit further out, and maintaining this right now in this economy and so forth is iffy, but that's where we're trying to go.
Outstanding. Well, I look forward to seeing how it evolves, and you'll certainly be back at more of these events.
Yeah,
so
I hope
so. We'll keep checking in with you, and I really hope Niners will... download Newspeak as it exists today, play around with it, and get feedback back to you.
Absolutely.
Right on.
Well, thanks very much, Charles.
Thank you. Great job.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely.